Nonetheless, as the war befell them, even Iraqis with a sophisticated understanding of the global oil economy remained suspicious about American motives. They did not believe necessarily that the United States intended to steal their country's reserves directly, but they regarded Iraq's oil as an essential context for the American invasion. History influenced them. Without question, oil grabs had shaped Western intervention in the Middle East in the past.
"The First World War was not about oil," said Tariq Shafiq, who had helped to draft Iraq's post-invasion oil law. "But the loot to the victorious winner was the oil concessions in the East. The intention was not there, but that was the obvious outcome. Today, with the oil being really the core of our civilization, you would expect that oil was a factor."
From its thunderous opening salvos in the early hours of March 20, 2003, the American-led invasion of Iraq did unfold in ways that exacerbated such doubts, particularly among Iraqis. On their initial drive to Baghdad, American tanks and jeeps refueled at depots called Exxon and Shell. The decision to choose those code names might be dismissed as the tone-deaf error of mid-level staff in the Pentagon's bureaucracy. It proved to be a signal of a deeper and persistent ambiguity. Talking points written at the National Security Council and handed out to American officials charged with making contact with Iraq's oil bureaucrats during the early days of the invasion instructed them to emphasize, "We're not here for the oil. The oil belongs to the Iraqi people." Paul Bremer, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, or CPA, and the de facto regent of the country until 2004, declared that Iraq's natural resources should be shared by all Iraqis, and that revenues from the sale of oil should be placed in transparent bank accounts to create a humane social safety net for the Iraqi people. In private, however, officials within Bremer's occupation authority wrestled over the organizational mechanisms, as Douglas Feith had put it, that would govern Iraq's post-invasion oil industry. Standard Oil first invested in what became the Iraq Petroleum Company in 1928. By the 1960s, international oil companies, including Esso, the ExxonMobil precursor, still owned a share of Iraq Petroleum. Iraq later nationalized its oil industry and organized state-owned firms, akin to Saudi Arabia's Aramco. In its heyday, the flagship Iraq National Oil Company and its affiliates were highly professional, led by Iraqi engineers trained in the United Kingdom and the United States. Under Saddam Hussein, however, the state-run oil complex atrophied. By the time of the U.S.-led invasion, a few aging technocrats held Iraq's oil infrastructure together with proverbial gum and paper clips. The complex's maintenance problems ran so deep, you could have brought the whole of ExxonMobil out there, and they wouldn't have been able to operate that thing worth a damn, said Philip J. Carroll, a former president of Shell USA, who was appointed by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld to serve as Paul Bremer's first senior oil advisor. Even before the American invasion, it was clear, at least to some Iraqi exiles and American war planners, that a post-Saddam Iraqi government would have to consider whether to invite international oil companies to invest and help solve these deep-seated infrastructure problems. If a liberated Iraqi government wanted to draw on large sums of international capital to revitalize oil production, it would probably have to give up at least some equity oil reserves in return by signing production-sharing contracts with international oil majors or through outright privatization. And yet allowing foreign companies to own Iraqi oil would undermine the Bush administration's public narrative that the war would not reduce Iraq's sovereign control of its natural resources. A desperate Saddam Hussein, toward the end of his time in power, had signed production-sharing contracts with Russian and Chinese companies, but those agreements had never been implemented. Otherwise, no Iraqi government had allowed outside oil ownership in four decades. Some financially and politically weak, high-risk nations elsewhere still accepted production-sharing contracts. Azerbaijan, Indonesia, and Chad were among them. But such deals typically generated controversy, and they had essentially been banished as a contract genre in the Middle East. Bush administration war planners anticipated this dilemma as they worked in secret before the conflict. The Oil and Energy Working Group of the Future of Iraq Project, a State Department planning body, noted in a paper written early in 2003 that post-war Iraq would require foreign investment on the terms that best, rapidly, and significantly increase oil and gas production, but that Iraqi privatization schemes or production-sharing contracts could engender opposition from those who see this as selling out to foreign oil companies. Some free-market conservatives within and around the Bush administration saw no reason why a post-Saddam Iraqi government should feel embarrassed about trading some oil reserves for access to foreign capital and technology. In their view, all countries were better off if they privatized their economies to the greatest possible extent. "Privatization works everywhere," a paper published by the Heritage Foundation declared in 2002 as the Iraqi invasion neared. Its authors urged the Bush administration to work with Iraqi opposition leaders at once to prepare to privatize government assets after Saddam's overthrow. In Baghdad, immediately after the invasion, Thomas Foley, a business school classmate of George W. Bush's, organized a cell of privatization enthusiasts inside Paul Bremer's CPA. Foley and his colleagues pushed plans for a broad-based mass privatization program even before a transitional Iraqi government could be established. Iraqi technocrats who served as caretakers at the oil ministry in that heady, chaotic spring and early summer of 2003 following Saddam's fall were stunned by the radicalism of some of the ideas the arriving Americans proposed. Pentagon planners suggested that Iraq should consider withdrawing from OPEC. "This was part of the neoconservative view. Why have Iraq in OPEC?" recalled one American official involved. "Let's break the cartel." The idea seemed preposterous to experienced Middle East hands, as such a proposal would only confirm ordinary Iraqis' worst fears about American intentions. State Department opponents of the proposal sought to dismiss it out of hand, an official involved recalled. And yet the idea kept resurfacing. Pentagon officials also suggested that Iraq's oil ministry look into shipping crude down the Haifa pipeline, as they referred to it. The pipeline had been constructed in 1934 to serve territory that eventually became part of the State of Israel. It ran from Iraq's oil-producing region around Kirkuk through Jordan to modern Israel's coastal city of Haifa. It ceased operations after Israel's birth in 1948, but it was marked on old maps.